Unless you're planning to do some poorly matched impedance rotation. In other words, if you have a perfectly matched system, you have a 50-ohm load on your antenna, you have 50-ohm impedance on your coax, you have 50-ohm requirement for your transmitter, the lens will not change the impedance at all. If you have a mismatch over time, over the length of the coax, the impedance will get rotated. But that's a function of, and how it does that is related in some ways to the velocity factor, because that defines how long a wavelength is in the coax itself. But as far as I can see, there's no reason to be particularly concerned about changing velocity factors. You just keep that in mind if you're ever doing something like using a time domain reflectometer. It kind of assumes a given velocity factor, so the information might be a little bit off. Otherwise, you can swap different coax cables as long as their impedance is the same.
Okay, Roy, and reading up on these chokes, the theory I'm getting, and you want to prevent the mismatches at the antenna, and that's where the common modes, if I'm understanding correctly, start and come back. However, the people at Expert told me to put it at the back of the amplifier. Put this make a dirty balance and put it at the back of the amplifier, which to me just sounds counterintuitive. That would stop the RF from going into the amplifier. I think that's what they want to achieve, the common mode going back into the amplifier. But wouldn't that also then make the transmission line part of the antenna also?
Well, if you didn't have, it sort of depends on how you configure this. They may have meant that you could put an RF choke at the feed point, but they would also suggest that you put an RF choke at the input to their amplifier. So the initial RF choke will block reflections off the antenna feed point. It's theoretically possible that if you put the coax too close to the radiating antenna, you can have a kind of antenna-like phenomena on the outer shield, and you can get common mode current that way as well. So by putting another RF choke by the input of your amplifier, by the output of your amplifier, rather, you limit that route for common mode and RF to get into your machinery. But, two are fine. I would certainly put the antenna feed point RF choke in first, and if necessary, it's a simple thing to put a second one at the other end of your transmission line. As I said before, as long as it's differential mode, you could line the whole darn thing with RF chokes. It's not going to have any effect.
Understood. Yeah, the people there at Expert were worried that they didn't want me to put one up by the antenna, just at the back of the linear. And like many times, you're caught between two doctors giving you advice, and ultimately you're going to make the decision, and you're the least qualified. But listen, Roy, thank you for your time. You always give me a lot to think of and a lot to grow on and a lot of questions answered and put to rest. And I'm not going to hold up the net. Thank you for everybody with your input. And I'm going to be on the side listening and back to the net. November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Okay, very good, John. Thanks for participating. And as always, as you learn more things out there, come back and share it with us. And if you have any further questions, you know where to find us.
Thank you, Roy. A gentleman as always.
Likewise. Joe, KC2QIW, I hope you're still with us. Do you have a question for tonight?
Hey, love you guys. I'm just enjoying the conversation and just listening for today, and no questions, maybe next week. And this is Joe, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey from Harrison, New York, and back to the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Joe. Rich, W2BZ, what's your question for tonight?
First question is Selden noisy to anybody else but me with the snap, pop, and crackles? Go ahead.
Anyone out there in Selden want to answer that question? Because I'm here in Brooklyn.
Hey, yes, it's noisy tonight, over.
Okay, just want to know if it was my radio, my antenna, or the repeater. The first question is, this is the people who build their own computers. If there's anybody who builds their own computers out there, have you run into a disk repair or disk recovery software or heard about one that's supposed to be, you know, the best of them all, quote unquote? Because I'm telling you, I have a computer that does what it wants every time it gets turned on, and I'm thinking it might be the power supply, or the voltage going into the power supply or something, because I've been playing with computers for 40 years, and I've never run into as quirkiness as this. It's usually one thing or another, but this is everything all at once. Anybody have any comments?
C2GJE, have you measured the voltages at the power supply, over?
No, I haven't. What I'm going to... I should have done that by this time already. But what I am going to do is swap out the power supply to a much lower power supply, much lower wattage power supply, but that I know works. That's next, if I have the strength. But I've never seen different malfunctions in one computer, whether it's a disk drive, whether it's the BIOS, it's just the thing's gone crazy. And just when I need to deliver some work to a client, maybe this week, just when I need to do that, of course, that's what it is. But has anybody run into a bad power supply or a power supply that varies in voltage that causes all sorts of problems? Back to that.
KB2HHU.
Yes, HHU.
Like the gentleman said, you know, the voltages for those switching power supplies in a computer are really kind of critical. They're actually, if you really want to go with this, you look on Amazon, if you really want to do this, they have these modules where you can plug in your motherboard connector for the various power supplies. I don't remember how many pins it is off the top of my head, but it actually has a bunch of LEDs on it that can actually tell you on a quick look what the voltages are for, like, you know, the plus 5 volts line and so on, the various voltages to see if it checks out. Kind of a visual thing if you want to go for it. I don't think they're terribly expensive if you want to go that way. But yeah, I work on PCs, and if, you know, these power supplies malfunction, you can get weird things like random reboots, blue screens of death, as they say, and so on. It can get pretty wild, and it's very hard to trace. I have seen that with, the machines at work, so, you know, definitely something to look into.
You know, you just reminded me that I do have a power supply tester. I haven't used it in 6-7 years. We'll see what it says. But it's also coincidental. You mentioned a random reboot. I just got a random reboot. I've never gotten a random reboot that I can remember after a disk was settled and the desktop was on the screen. I never got a random reboot. So it could very well be the power supply. I'm going to swap it out for the other power supply. I mean, I've rebuilt two computers in the last 2 days, and I still haven't solved this problem. It all started with a Windows 10 it's going south and me not having and not being able to recover it to get it operational again. And I guess everybody has their opinion about recovery tools, but does anybody know what's supposed to be the creme de la creme of recovery tools? Go ahead.
Fred, this is K2BCV.
Yes, go ahead.
Roger, this is Gene, K2BCV. When it comes to the computer acting really strange, I've had many, many situations where the CMOS battery is on the edge and it creates all kinds of grief. So I don't know if you check the CMOS battery. Change the CMOS battery and it might correct the problem. This is Gene, K2BCV. Go ahead.
That's a curious one. I would think that if the battery went bad, what would happen is when you powered it down, it would just lose all the settings, as opposed to when you powered it up. I didn't think it particularly relies on the battery when it's in the power mode.
Well, sometimes it could be on the edge, you know, and sometimes when it's on the the borderline, some strange things happen. Go ahead.
Okay. I think the quickest, the easiest is to swap out the power supply. I'm curious, Rich, what wattage are you going from and to?
I'm going from 650 to 250.
Okay, so then the magic question is, and I doubt that you're running any particularly powerful graphics cards. Those are the usual things that suck up the power.
Oh, I don't even have the CD-ROM drive attached. There's nothing but the good, you know, a low-powered graphics card, and that's it. That's the only thing, and the hard drive. That's the only thing, and various hard drives attached to this computer. And every time I do something, it's given me something else that goes wrong with it. It's crazy. And I did replace it in case. I did reset the CMOS just in case. And nothing. Like I said, I've been into this for decades, and I've never been able to revive a computer before, or partially, or let's say 90% revive a computer. Never until now. And of course, like I say, it's when I need to deliver a project. Okay, that's one question. The other question, by the way, was. Has anybody successfully, and does anybody love a disk recovery program out there?
HHU.
Yeah, HHU.
The program I use at work, and there's others that do the same thing. If you're looking for data recovery, I'm assuming something along the lines of you. Well, we have I work at a school district, and what we have a lot of times is teachers and kids come in with pen drives, USB drives that, you know, who knows where they've been, and they've lost the data on them, where the partition, so to speak, is, you know, gone, info. But the files can still be recovered sometimes. It depends on how bad it is. You talking about that kind of recovery?
Well, I'm looking for, I'm actually looking for boot recovery rather than partition recovery.
Okay. I mean, you can just look that up on the internet. I mean, there's quite a day. I mean, I use this thing called EASEUS, partition recovery. And I believe it does have a set of disk tools with it that you could probably, you know, it would probably try to recover boot sectors and stuff like that. And that's not the only show in town. It's just something I have. I usually do more of the data recovery where, you know, the whole world is on a USB key and there's no backup and, you know, you're the big hero if you can save some files, that kind of thing. But the boot recovery, these tools all do that probably as well, recover the boot sectors.
I know Roy uses AOMI, is that right? AOMI, is that how you pronounce it?
I use Acronis.
An Acronis. Well, you know, they have samples of them all, and then if if it recovers anything for you, then, you know, they charge you an arm and a leg for it. Data recovery, you know, there is a big, expensive, lucrative business for corporations. They lose a disk or some kind of drive or even a tape drive. I mean, I've heard of companies that charge $5,000 a hard drive to reconstruct it. So, anyway, the second question is, I'm into watches, too, mostly automatic watches. And I'm always interested in new watches and technology. So I'll ask you, Roy, what did you get and what's so special about it?
Well, I mean, personally, what I got isn't so special because I can't afford to spend the ridiculous amount of money for Bleeding Edge. I put up some links to Bleeding Edge watches. There's a Boulevard, let's see, which... There's one watch that uses electrostatic motors instead of stepper motors. It's very reminiscent of my Wimhurst machine. There's another one that the quartz movement that's so accurate, it is plus or minus 1 second per year, and it charges off of ambient light. But that goes for about $7,000, which is way past my breaking point. I just got a Seiko. I really like lunar watch complications. Many years ago, I had a Seiko that had a lunar dial, and it failed. And I've tried to get it repaired, and they just tell me there's no parts for it. It's just, you know, they can't do anything. So I've been searching for lunar complications, and I found a Seiko that got marked down 60% in the last couple of months, and I figured I was a good boy and I deserved a toy. So it's a Seiko Premier Kinetic with a lunar complication.
Don't mention that word complication. Let me let it drop to see if I have it. The word complication I like to hear because I had a Patek Philippe that was a dime thin. I sold it for $3,500. If it had one complication, just one complication, it would have been $20,000. Back to net.
Yeah, I mean, Swiss mechanical watches, I mean, unfortunately to me, I can kind of understand the allure, but it's not anything to do with rationality. Mechanical watches, some of the finest mechanical watches known to mankind, have less accuracy than a $30 quartz watch. So you're not getting accuracy. You're not getting timekeeping. Sometimes you're getting even worse timekeeping. And you're paying thousands of dollars. A lot of those watches started around $7,000, $8,000. So all the way up, there's this one crazy guy on YouTube who apparently is a music producer who was probably very, very successful because he flashes million-dollar watches that are enormous. I wouldn't fit them in as a belt buckle. They're so big, but he wears them on his wrist. So the European mechanical watch market is a strange place. It seems like a bit of a fetish to me. I can sort of understand it, but when I hear the numbers of how much you have to pay for one of those things, I just can't see myself. You know, there are some watches where you could basically buy a house, a car, and, you know, basically living expenses for 10 years instead of wearing something that's way too big on your wrist.
Comment in one whitey white.
Yes, Hank.
Yeah, when I started my career, we all wore mechanical watches made in Switzerland because they were simply the thing you could use and you could read it in the cockpit at night to time your instrument approach. When I ended my career, we were all using $100 analog Japanese-made quartz watches. Various cases, but essentially the same quartz movement in almost every one of them.
Rusts are automatic. They used to call them mechanical, or they used to call them automatic. I call them automatic. The Breitlings, which a lot of pilots love to wear, are, I think, the real ones anyway, not the counterfeit ones, are mostly automatic. But listen, if you walk in with a $100,000 watch, you could be 10 minutes late, you know? You earned it. Go ahead.
Well, comment about the Breitling.
Yeah, sure. Comment away.
Yeah, the E60 rotary flight computer that's on the outside of that Breitling, that's called an Abitimer, that we all think we want when we are young and we can't afford it, and when we're old enough to afford it, our eyes aren't good enough to read it.
Yeah, I've noticed that, unfortunately, with my new watch. It has a nice deep blue and some red gold accents and such, and or pseudo, and it's not easy, the easiest on the eyes. But I mean, you know, mechanical watches are fascinating. When Rich mentions the automatic, he means the automatic self-winding mechanical. There are kind of automatic, sort of self-winding or really self-charging quartz watches. They have kind of the same principal object. They have a weight that rotates as you move your wrist around, and instead of driving the drive spring, it drives a little dynamo that charges up the rechargeable either battery or supercapacitor that works like a battery in the quartz watch. But, you know, the Swiss mechanical movement thought that they were going to die as soon as the quartz watch was invented. And they sort of reinvented themselves and have made a lot of money. Some of them are beautiful, some of them are gaudy, some of them are ugly as sin, but they're all expensive.
Watch as big as a belt buckle, knows nothing about watches. Go ahead.
Well, but you don't have to know anything about watches. Gone are the days where, at least from my viewing of way too many YouTubes, gone are the days where anyone seems to give a damn about a super thin watch. They're not in it for the super thinness. They get bigger and wider and more ridiculous. Sometimes they're not in it for the complication. The $7,000 Citizen watch that's 1 second plus or minus a year is basically just a minute, hour, and a second hand. Doesn't even give you the date. So you can make it very, very simple, complication-free, but apparently no one cares about it being thin anymore, because I've seen some gargantuan things on people's wrists.
Again, those are like the Invictus and some of the other watches, some of the other manufacturers that make these huge, gaudy watches where the rim, I forgot the technical name, so the rim looks like diamonds, but they're not diamonds, you know, and they're just, you know, 10 times the size of the guy's wrist, and the guy's a football player. Those aren't the watches. In terms of the very, very thin watches, they're still pretty much in favor. I mean, especially if they're Swiss, and especially if they have complications, those watches could go... I've seen them at auction for, you know, a couple of $1 million, but they're considered antiques, I guess. But anyway, the watch world is a fascinating world. There has to be 20 websites dedicated just to knockoffs, just to counterfeit watches. And I don't know how Rolex and all these other companies how they stay in business with how fast the Chinese knock this stuff off. And, you know, like automatic ones, too, not just quartz, automatic ones. Go ahead.
Yes, Wesley recognized. Let me just comment. The Chinese are making excellent rip-offs of things like Rolex. There are also a lot of YouTubes available that show the advancement of them copying. Rolex is one of the go-to brands that the Chinese companies rip off, because there is an endless demand for Rolexes. Again, personally, I don't really see it, but they're worth their weight in I don't know what, far better than gold, probably. But they can do rather sophisticated things. I don't know if you were ever interested in a device called a turbulent. Basically, it's French for whirlwind. It's a governor regulator on pocket watches that got included into wristwatches because it looks pretty and is ridiculously hard to build and expensive. And there are Chinese companies. Usually, if you buy a watch with a turbulent in it, it starts at around $12,000-$13,000 and goes all the way up. The Chinese are selling a turbulent for a couple thousand bucks. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
I had a question. I sent you an email, you probably didn't see that. If you have a time, who's assigned to you?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we still have 45 minutes before Space Report, and I thought we'd talk about other things, and when we run out of these other things and people's questions, we'll go to science. I'm always interested in science.
May I proceed?
KD2VBN here?
Yes, what's your first name?
Well, my name is Thomas. I just received my technicians last week, so I'm pretty excited. I have just a simple bio thing, and I am a scan enthusiast. I have a disco mounted to my fire escape, so I'm using that right now.
Oh, great. Congratulations. Welcome to the club. Amateur radio is a fascinating hobby. It has a breadth and depth that I think kind of outstrips most hobbies that I'm aware of. You can go into all kinds of different avenues, and it's fun. It could be a social hobby. It could be a asocial hobby. Hopefully it's never an antisocial hobby, but welcome aboard.
Yes, thank you much. I was reading, too, that licensed ham operators are only 0.2% of the population, so I'm very happy and have a lot of pride now that I've joined the crew, I guess. But I guess as a newbie, and I see this is a NetTech learning my way around, I was just wanting to ask as far as what would be the best approach to building up my rig and researching and looking into getting good building my system.
Okay, yeah, that's a great question, and hopefully we'll get some participation from a few of the people out there listening. Ultimately, it really depends upon where this hobby kind of attracts you. Again, because it's so wide. Right now, you're enjoying VHF. Right next to VHF is UHF. There's repeaters. There's simplex communication point to point. There's satellites. There's the ISS. There is relatively more distant VHF and UHF using single sideband, and you know, that's only UHF VHF. You could go in one direction and play around in microwave, although that's kind of bleeding edge, or you can go in the other direction and go into HF, which is most of the history of amateur radio, from 160 meters all the way up to 6 meters. You could do learn Morse code, do CW, you can do AM, or you can do single sideband, or you could use computer modes like PSK-31 or FT-8, which is great if you just want to tag base and collect a list of different places all over the world. Phone is more suitable for ranching and having conversations. So, you know, what someone once suggested to me was to get a general coverage radio and just listen to as many of the amateur radio bands as I can and get a feel for what interests me and what doesn't.
That's right. And, of course, the most reasonable part in the equation is education. So I think my next step there will be taking the general. I appreciate all your input, KDC, BBM.
Yes, indeed. It's always good. You know, the different levels give you different access. The technician's license is the simplest one and easiest one to be gotten. It gives you a slight feel for phone on HF, on 10 meters. There are little portions of the frequency where you can communicate via phone. But it kind of limits you a great deal on the other HF frequencies. General class gives you access to every band in amateur radio. It doesn't give you the entirety of the band. For that, you would need an extra license. But I wish you luck on getting the general. I think it's a valuable thing to have. It really widens your horizon.
Roger. Yeah, I found this group here because it's been quite useful, my scanner, because I'm able to scan the upper and lower limits of both the 2-meter and 70-centimeter band, and I was able to come across this group. So when does it meet? So I'll be checking in on the regular here.
Yeah, you're probably listening to the Glen Oaks W2BL. It also is relayed to Selden. It's the repeaters of the Limark, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. It has a bunch of nets, but this one is the technical net. It's every Sunday night, 8 o'clock to about 11. It's been going on since 1982. Under the direction of Dick K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key earlier this year. And there are archives available if you're interested. If you go to a website called amateurradio.tv, it'll give you archives going as far back as 2006.
That's a Roger. I'll look into that. All right. Well, thank you very much, and I'll be standing by and enjoying the picnic here.
And into RVP?
Yes.
I just been listening. I was having a problem. My rig was, I had to reprogram it from the software. I couldn't figure out how to get back to the A's memory bank, well, my frequency. But anyway, congratulations to the ham. You can do whatever you want with the hobby. Making back the watches. I love watches. I love to have a Rolex watch. If I had money, I'd get one. But I wear a Timex watch. They're great. I got it over in the Tanger outlet. It's got analog, and it's got a digital. So if I go, say, to California on vacation, I could leave the digital side in New York, and I could program the analog side where I'm at. I don't know what time zone. And also, I like Bowen. I have a Bowen airplane that comes around. It's really cool. I've been wearing these watches for years. And I have another Bowen watch, and that's what I wear for watches pretty much. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of watches. There are so many different designs, so many different complications. For people who don't know, or, well, not that you don't care, but you just don't know. It's Complications is just the way people call things other than just this, your watch telling you what time it is right now. So if you have the day of the week or the date or the lunar calendar or, all kinds of other little things, each of those little things is called a complication on a watch. And usually the more complications, the more it costs, and usually the bigger and bulkier they tend to get. It's fascinating. I had Timex when I was younger. I kind of liked Seiko. It was a nice little medium price point. I never really could wrap my head around spending thousands of dollars for a wristwatch. Especially nowadays, they're kind of redundant. Almost everyone I know has a cell phone, which, surprise, surprise, has a very accurate clock in it, and other people are buying iWatches and such. One of the interesting things that I kind of looked into was the ultimate accuracy of a watch. And a self-contained watch, the most accurate that I came up with was that $7,000 one that was 1 second plus or minus a year. But for a lot less money, you can buy one that's cheap. The so-called atomic watches, not that it has a built-in cesium or rubidium atomic clock inside of it, because those things, even the best, are about the size of a large matchbox. You couldn't really fit it into a watch movement. But very much like atomic clocks that people have in their kitchen and such, it's able to receive the accuracy time sequence signals from time stations and correct itself. So it can lose next to nothing in theoretically thousands of years as long as the transmitting atomic clock someplace is still kept functioning. So that's a little add-on for the most accurate clock out there. But, whatever floats your boat. I was never really into Rolexes. I don't know. They just didn't aesthetically interest me. There was nothing that I found special, but apparently there's a lot of people who think it's very special because those guys can't seem to make enough.
Roger on that. Yeah, I can't wear a watch with a metal band. I have, I think, a pinched nerve on that because I've got carpal syndrome, so it bothers my wrist. I wear leather bands, But Bowen has this real cool watch. I've had them for years. The design has an airplane. It's invisible. It's got a dial, so you see the airplane hand. It's pretty cool, Yeah, I know the phone has the time, but you have to take it off your belt to look at the time. So watch is easier. I will look at the time on my phone also, obviously. Yeah, when it comes to the time, WWV, when I used to, on my car, when I would have like the right antenna, I would listen to it and program my clock to it. Back to you.
Yeah, I used to use WWV as well. Then I got atomic clocks, and I have found that over the years they've made the receivers much more sensitive than they once were. We had this conversation on the TechNet a year or two ago when someone was having a big problem with their atomic clock, and I told the story that I used to, because my house is kind of built like a Faraday cage. I've mentioned this before. It's plastered using chicken wire on the 2x4s, and then they cover it in plastic. That's the way things were in the 50s. So it's a bit of a Faraday cage. So what I used to do was take my atomic clocks, especially when the time, when daylight savings and regular Eastern time shifted, I would take it over by a window, and that way I would get the signal out. So, whatever floats your boat, like I said before. A lot of people, I think, don't wear watches anymore. I've been deeply disappointed to hear of people in their 30s who were never really taught to read an analog watch and clock, and they much prefer digital clocks, and I find that as a sad thing, but what can you do? Yes, Wesley.
Did you check because my email?
Well, I got two emails a couple of days ago that you sent me an email about metal 3D printers. And about, say about 20 minutes ago, you sent me a much larger, multi-length email.
With your permission, may I proceed?
Okay, I just want to make sure that no one else has any comments to make before we move on.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I just want to let anybody wanted to watch a SpaceX Falcon 9 launch at night from Florida. It's going to do that at 9:56 tonight, you know, 15 minutes from now or so. So if you go to the SpaceX webcast, you know, they'll have that on live. And the cool part is to watch the booster come down. It's 159-foot, 12-foot diameter booster to land in the Atlantic Ocean on this autonomous ship. The ship is about as big as a football field, and this thing comes down vertically. So, they've done this many, many times before. In fact, this booster, it's the seventh flight for this booster. You know, they keep reusing it. That's how they drove the price down. So if you want to watch that, it'll come on live at about...
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Yeah, I remember watching that, and I had flashbacks to science fiction movies that I watched that were made in the 50s, early 60s. It's sort of amazing that the future is upon us.
I doubled to something at the end. I think something happened at the end. What did you say, Roy?
I said that I saw the early ones, the return and land, and it was like watching a movie from the 50s and 60s. Is the future is upon us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And they had one land in California on Friday night. That was really neat, too. Okay. Back to you, Roy.
Okey-doke. So, Wesley, you want to tell us about something?
I have a few science news. Usually I'm coming with something that is just 2 days, 3 days old. It is not necessarily the technology is 2-3 days old, but it is just the news. Let me jump. In England, we have a company that is being called Car-Go, Car by K. K-A-R.go. The main chief and scientist in this company is a Hindu guy, and he was able to get a nice crew of people, and they created, his name is Aparyat Narayan, and the company is called Academy of Robotics, Cargo, self-driving autonomous delivery car. Now, what is interesting about that concept, and that this car is already driving, is that this car doesn't use GPS. So it's an autonomous vehicle that doesn't have any passengers and doesn't have a driver. It is used strictly for delivery of goods. So let's say... from point A to point B is 10 miles or 3 miles or 2 miles or 20 miles. The car is able to drive with a speed of 93 miles per hour. And not using GPS, the car is learning. The car is able to recognize people crossing by, is able to maneuver between the cars, keep the line, and learn how to drive from point A to point B. The more car drives, the more the car learns. Of course, there is right now a vehicle that is following that car, but it looks like the car doesn't make much more mistakes. The link is in your email, so you have A, B, and the main link at point number one. Any questions?
Well, yeah, apparently it uses something called simultaneous localization and mapping. So instead of using the satellite as reference, it's sort of like, if you will, those little robot vacuums that go around your house and map out the location of all the boundaries and such. So my understanding is NVIDIA is involved. They're doing a lot with our artificial intelligence. So no doubt the chips from NVIDIA are being used in this simultaneous localization and mapping algorithm technology.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
They just scrubbed that mission until tomorrow. So that Falcon 9 won't take off until tomorrow night. Just to let you know, back to you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Well, hopefully, better luck next time. Wes?
A receiver observatory in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is being demolished. It is a 57-year-old structure. The telescope structure is in danger of catastrophic failure. The structure should be demolished in a controlled way as soon as pragmatically possible. It endures hurricanes, endless humidity, and a recent string of strong earthquakes. A massive radio telescope in Puerto Rico was used by scientists worldwide able to make a few essential discovery in the space area, but also was used for developing of missiles and rockets. What it says in here is it was used for radio astronomy, planetary, solar system, geospace research, and search for extraterrestrial life, according to NSF statement. I saw the pictures and it has a few holes, although some organizations of Puerto Rico want to preserve that structure for the future, and also they see it as an attraction for the tourists, as they have right now so many problems. Any attempts at repairs could put workers in potentially life-threatening danger, so it is likely going to go down soon. Any questions? Go ahead.
Thank you. I think one thing that really needs to be pointed upon, Arecibo was unique in its ability to transmit. This allowed for a technique called planetary radar. Literally bouncing things off other planets and receiving other radio astronomy facilities never have the capability to prepare to go. And I think that's a gift of law.
Absolutely agree with that. A few things about that observatory. It was 305 meters across. Spherical reflector, 1,000, that would be 1,000 feet. Dish built into the natural sinkhole. A cable mount, a stereo receiver mount at elevation of 492 feet, which would be 150 meters above the dish. A several radar transmitters for emitting the signals. Here I have a question, because that was used mostly as a receiving station. Dr. Roy, maybe you can correct that.
In terms of what? Most of its fame has been, to my understanding, as a receiving device, but as Matt mentioned, it also served the other purpose.
that is correct. There was a military application that was foreseen for that observatory to serve. But the thing is that in information that I see, National Astronomy and the Ionosphere Center installed several radar transmitters for emitting signals. For more than 50 years, the Arecibo Observatory was world's largest single aperture telescope, surpassed in July 2016 by a 500-meter aperture spherical telescope in China. So they wanted to be better. My question was, what was the purpose of transmitter installed there?
Well, I don't know the specifics. Matthew mentioned that it operated as a radar-like array to, I guess, investigate the more local phenomena that reflect the RF back at the observer. It really wouldn't be terribly useful for far more distant objects, but locally, asteroids, meteorites, and probably things like the moon could be manipulated with radio wave transmission and getting a bounce back.
I found some additional information. The origin of the observatory traced to late 1950 efforts to develop anti-ballistic missile ABM defenses as part of newly formed IARPA ABM umbrella effort project Defender. Even at this early stage, it was clear that the use of radar decoys. Would be a serious problem at long ranges need to successfully attack warhead ranges the order of 1,600 kilometers, that would be 1,000 miles. And to exchange.
Across the solar system, and Arecibo was able to do a significant amount of observation on that on account of the fact that Arecibo could transmit. FAST is the FAST observatory in China, is super important, but they don't have transmission capability.
Matthew, unfortunately, three quarters of that was doubling with West.
Yeah, would you repeat, Matthew? I'm sorry.
Apologies for overtalking you, West. In a nutshell, planetary radio allows you to finely tune space missions for planetary missions. For Mars, it lets you know exactly the timing you need to coordinate your mission. The second thing is that it also allows us to observe interplanetary objects like Luna Lunar. And I'm getting that name wrong. But you can reflect radio signals off that and do different types of things.
WRN?
Kilo 1, Whiskey Romeo, November. Calling from Long Island, or Connecticut.
Yes, what's your first name?
It's Chris, sir. Charlie Hotel Romeo, India, Sierra. From New Haven County, Connecticut. I was just listening to you on your net. Thought I would jump in and say hello. I've been listening for a little bit now.
Okay, very good, Chris. Glad to have you aboard. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. You're more than welcome to join us.
All right, thank you, sir. and I will be listening, K1WR.
Okay, very good. Wes, back to you.
Okay. So it was also serving anti-ballistic missile defense in 1950s, at least it was an idea, and radars were the choice that should disorient warheads, but they were disorienting all traffic there. Let me go to the next subject. Yeah, we have a problem with the climate change, and we have a problem with Asia as the most polluting part of the world. And there are two instances that took attention of the scientists. Stunning flamboyance of migrating flamingos folks to Kazakhstan Lake Karakol. The problem is that those pink birds were much late to travel their usual route, and they decided to stop by in Kazakhstan, which they didn't do for years. We have another event. Some 100,000 birds flew in 2 weeks late this year after an exceedingly hot September. Rising concerns global warming may play a role in delay. So the note here is that we have 100,000 of cranes that flew a little late, which is only 2 weeks. But we have found that the disaster that was created to an environment during the recent years was not in line with former President Trump's agenda, trying to exclude United States from any or every possible movement in this field. Any questions? And to exchange. Okay. So we have that subject would be very short because that's not my domain. That would be in space report. But Russians. Well, at first Russia was famous from the hole that was made by some Russian. Probably having a mental difficulty, but why did they send him to the space? And he made a hole in the wall which was leaking air from inside out. But now we have a new news that Russians are performing disconnection on one of the modules, and they want to connect another module which didn't arrive yet, which is called Nauka, which is in English science. That would be in space report. Any questions? Okay, next one. Israeli scientists claim to reverse aging process. 2 days ago, new research led by Tel Aviv University Sharikh Epahi, together with the team from Hamir Medical Center, found that when healthy adults over age 64 were placed in pressurized chambers and fit with some oxygen, they found that the reversal of the ordering. Let me jump. In other words, repeated intermittent hyperoxid increase oxygen level exposures induced by many of the mediators and a cellular mechanism that are usually induced during hypoxia, decrease oxygen level. Something Rocky explained is called the hyperoxygenation